Hello and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast. Episode 20, The Bonnie Prince Raises the Standard, aka that one from Outlander. When we left the Prince, his entourage and his troops were en route to Scotland aboard their two ships, the Detele and the Elizabeth. They sailed within a bright and sunny July day, and travelling under the pseudonym Mr. Douglas, Charles Edward Stuart prepared to return to his father's homeland to reclaim the British crown for the House of Stuart. The plan was to sail along the south coast of the UK, up the Irish Sea, and land in Scotland. This being a Jacobite plot, however, the wheels started to fall off around about the Lizard, just off the coast of Cornwall. As they passed within 100 miles or so of this landmark, a six-gun Royal Navy warship, the HMS Lion, was on patrol in the area and engaged the Elizabeth in a brutal close-range cannon fight. The Lion was, at the time, under the impression these were French ships or perhaps even privateers en route to America. They had no idea that the convoy they had attacked was a Jacobite invasion fleet. The fighting was intense. It resulted in both the Lion and the Elizabeth sustaining serious damage, and whilst the Lion had to limp only back to Plymouth, the Elizabeth was critically damaged, had lost its captain, and given that it housed all the arms and troops for the mission, this would put Charles's campaign in a precarious state. A crisis meeting was called on the Detele. The captain and senior Jacobites felt that since it was too dangerous to try and transfer troops and arms from the Elizabeth, given it had begun to list dangerously, it would be prudent to return to port in Brest, repair and resupply in France, and try again. But to Charles, that was despicable. If they were to turn back now, it would be game over for the Jacobites. Once again, Charles was willing to go full bore, London or bust. And so it was, that without most of his guns or his troops, Charles and his entourage continued to sail to Scotland. Buffeted by storms, the Detele eventually sighted Barra in the Outer Hebrides and made landing at Eriskay, a small island in the Outer Hebrides between Barra and South Uist. For the first time in 30 years, a member of the Jacobite House of Stuart had set foot in Britain, and Bonnie Prince Charlie's legend had begun to be born. The welcome he received from the Lords of Scotland was, unfortunately, a far from warm one. When he arrived with his entourage, he asked to see a senior member of Clan Ranald. Alexander MacDonald was the clan chief's half-brother, and he received word from Charles and his Jacobite entourage that the heir to the throne was here to discuss the plans of his retaking of the crown. MacDonald met with the prince and replied, with words to the effect that Charles should get back in his boat and head home to the Papal States. The time, he argued, was not right for a rising, and they were undermanned and underarmed. MacDonald then stuck the metaphorical knife in deeper, stating that not a single man in Scotland would rise to fight for the Jacobite cause, and he'd spoken with the heads of Clan Ranald and Clan MacLeod, and neither of them were willing to send troops. This message must have been quite jarring to the prince and his entourage, but even in his mid-twenties, Charles had spent years being raised into being the heir to the throne. He was probably used to hiding his true feelings and fears to project an image of regal stability. As cool as anything, Charles replied to this downbeat assessment with, "I am come home, sir, and I will entertain no notion at all of returning to that place from whence I came. I am persuaded my faithful Highlanders will stand by me." The next day, Charles sailed with his crew into Loch Namu and anchored at Barradale near Moidart. He went to meet with Clan Ranald, Cameron of Lochiel, and the MacDonalds of Glengarry, Glencoe, Keppoch, and Sleat. A Clan Ranald clansman is quoted in The King Over the Water as describing the prince in the following way. "There entered the tent a tall youth of a most agreeable aspect, in a plain black coat with a plain shirt, not very clean, and a cambric stock fixed with a plain silver buckle, a plain hat with a canvas string having one end fixed to the end of his coat buttons. He had black stockings and brass buckles in his shoes." Probably still in his divinity student disguise, he still cut an imposing distinctive figure, which was said to have swelled the heart of our writer of this account, who was heartened to see his prince return home. At the meeting with the clan chiefs, many of them continued to attempt to force Charles back to France. Cameron of Lochiel, the most powerful and influential of these chiefs, set out the problems. There were no troops, no guns, and Charles had neglected to keep what the Scots lords had asked for in Jacobite rebellions, and that was support by French troops. Since Charles had turned the Elizabeth round and sent her guns and troops away, By all rights, Lochiel argued, the prince hadn't upheld his half of the bargain, so the Highland clans could stay home. Lochiel had been warned en route to his meeting by his brother that Charles was extremely persuasive and charismatic. In Jacqueline Riding's Jacobites, John Cameron of Fassifern is said to warn Lochiel that meeting the prince face to face would be difficult, as this prince, once he sets his eyes upon you, he will make you do whatever he pleases. After receiving firm no answers consistently from the clan chiefs, Charles was somewhat prepared for this and had a rousing, emotive, forceful answer, possibly prepared but targeted to the wavering lords. "In a few days," Charles said, "with the few friends that I have, I will erect the royal standard and proclaim to the people of Britain that Charles Stuart is come over to claim the crown of his ancestors, to win it or perish in the attempt. Lochiel, who my father has often told me was our firmest friend, may stay at home and learn from the newspapers the fate of his prince." Whether this emotive statement, both calling for the loyalty promised and a possible barb at Lochiel for not wishing to fight, was planned to convince or castigate, it achieved what it intended to do. Lochiel replied to Charles that he would share the fate of his prince, and so shall every man over when nature or fortune hath given me power. His only provisos were a cash security to his estate, and that Glengarry would submit a pledge to rise for the prince in writing. Charles, of course, readily agreed to these terms. This about turn wasn't necessarily expected by the others, and with Lochiel signing up to support, the others fell in line. The MacDonalds of Glengarry, Keppoch, Clanranald and Glencoe all pledged troops, but MacDonald of Sleat refused, maintaining the reason originally given, that the time wasn't right and the resources weren't there. Charles, buoyed by the support of the men who pledged loyalty to him, established a small court at Borrowdale, where he led audiences with locals, dressed in Highland plaid, and sent messages all over Scotland to rally his supporters to Glenfinnan for the official raising of the royal standard and the formation of the army to take on the British government and the House of Hanover, by extension. Some people may wonder what the government were doing in London and Edinburgh at this point. Well, the truth is that rumours had been circulating amongst the French army in Europe that there was going to be an attempt on Scotland by Prince Charles and the Jacobites. This information did make its way back to Britain. One source was the British ambassador to the Netherlands, who was informed by his counterpart from France that Prince Charles had left Nantes for Scotland in July with troops, horses and arms for roughly 10,000 men. This information filtered back to London, where the threat of invasion by French forces was greeted with far more concern than any potential Jacobite involvement. At this time, the Duke of Newcastle wrote to the Duke of Cumberland in Flanders, stating his fears that the current forces stationed in Britain were in no way strong enough to repel a French invasion. Newcastle believed the country was best advised to deploy the Royal Navy and use them to fight off the invasion fleet. Others, however, felt this could have just been talk and a possible campaign of misinformation being pursued by King Louis and the French to get British troops diverted away from the fight in Europe. To be honest, that probably wasn't as a ridiculous idea as it sounds, but the initial intelligence was received muddied and unclear. There was a slightly clearer but no better coordinated picture in Scotland. One of the highest ranked men in Scotland was the Lord President of the Court of Session, Duncan Forbes. He had been hearing rumours of a possible rising since July 1745, passing on all information to Sir John Cope, the British Army's commander in Scotland. But unfortunately, Forbes thought little of the reports. His judgment might have been clouded by his experience of the clans in the Highlands. Forbes spent time at his home in Culloden House outside Inverness, meeting other chiefs and, if not convincing them to fight for the government, at least tried to convince them to remain neutral should the Jacobites try again. He felt it could be evident that the clan chiefs would not rise and a rebellion would not be taken up. Whether that's wishful thinking or not, from his experience, trusting people he was talking to far too much, or even downplaying just how effective a recruiting tool Prince Charlie could be when he was there in Scotland, it became clear there was some attempt would be made. And so he wrote to the Marquess of Tweedale, King George's Secretary of State for Scotland. In his correspondence, Forbes advised that even if the possibility was remote that Jacobites would try and land, the state should take precautions to repel such an assault. Firstly, Duncan Forbes said there should be some form of lieutenant of coordinating men who could command and unite all of the groups loyal to the House of Hanover. Second, there should be arms sent to Fort George, Fort William and Fort Augustus. These arms would then be distributed to loyal supporters to repel the Jacobite forces. This, Forbes argued, would be necessary, as loyal forces were likely to have disarmed as the government in Westminster had passed disarming acts in 1715 and 1719, requiring Scottish subjects to surrender arms following the previous Jacobite rebellions. Jacobite clans, Forbes argued, would not have surrendered their arms, and even those 20-odd-year-old arms caches beat what the loyal government forces could currently muster. Finally, Forbes recommended a government official should come north with money and or credit to reimburse pro-government lords. Many of the pro-government forces had paid for arms. They had also paid for forces, supplies and intelligence out of their own pocket. Forbes felt if the state could show those who fought to protect it that they would be reimbursed, the clans might support the government in larger numbers. These were all sensible suggestions, but it would appear to have fallen somewhat on deaf ears. Duncan Forbes arrived at Culloden House and started to try and coordinate a loyalist response. Having spoke to and received letters from MacLeod and MacDonald of Sleat, both of whom reiterated their opposition to the prince, although this had as much to do with Forbes threatening to prosecute them both for selling poor Scots and their tenants into slavery in America as it did for the love of the House of Hanover, both clans remained loyal and offered to pledge their assistance to the government. It was often said that the good personal relationships Forbes fostered between himself and clan chiefs contributed to many chiefs sticking with the Hanoverians. Forbes later wrote Sir John Cope, stating he was incredulous that Lochiel would join with the Jacobites, but admitted he hadn't heard from Lochiel in some time, and that any defection may have stemmed from the fact that there was currently a warrant out for the Lord's arrest. He also wrote to Cope of meeting with another Lord, the head of Clan Fraser, Simon Fraser, the Lord Lovat. We last met Simon when he was reporting to London about the state of Scotland's defences, prompting them to send George Wade up to examine and report back. Fraser had spent the intervening years strengthening his power and influence throughout the Highlands. In London, Lovat had tried to ingratiate himself in the government, looking for a way to gain prestige. He'd failed to make any headway in this, so he chose to remain in the Highlands and stay loyal yet aloof. It was suspected by some that Lovat was playing both sides, becoming more talkative with the Jacobites after being removed for the control of the independent Highland Company he'd set up to defend the Hanoverian regime. Forbes and Fraser did not often see eye to eye on a lot of matters, but Lovat professed to Forbes that the rising was doomed to failure, and he couldn't understand, if the reports were true, why Lochiel would side with what was clearly a losing cause. Despite all this, though, Fraser stalled and delayed on committing actual troops to the government. This was typical of what Forbes described as Lovat's shilly-shallying, holding out for the best steel. Forbes wrote to Cope that he hoped the army would be out and able to root out any rebels. There were British army patrols in Scotland at this time, one of them under Captain John Sweetenham, on a mission from Ruthven Barracks in Canusie to Fort William. The purpose of Sweetenham's mission was to survey the fortifications in his capacity as an engineer. His story is told in the book Berehowst Banditti by Maggie Craig. Sweetenham was seized by Jacobite rebels and taken as a prisoner of war, in what could be considered one of the first major aggressive acts of the Jacobite Rising of 1745. Sweetenham was taken to the banks of Loch Shiel and witnessed a spectacular piece of political theatre. On August the 19th, 1745, Charles and his entourage had waited at the area of Glenfinnan for roughly 3 hours, and probably felt quite nervous at the wait. Fortunately for him, pipers were heard on the breeze, and Lochiel and his promised contingent of troops made their way to the rallying point the prince had set for the clan chiefs. Lady Jenny Cameron came, bringing her contingent, as well as other clans who rose for the prince. These assembled Jacobites watched as William Murray, the former Marquess of Tullibardine, unfurled the Jacobite royal standard, and read aloud the declaration of King James proclaimed king, and Prince Charles acting as his regent. Brandy was passed around from casks, and Gallic cries of Joch Slanty an Rig to the king's health were uttered. 2 days after this momentous event, John Sweetenham, the captive captain, was released from the Jacobites, on the promise he would not return to the British army and would not provide any opposition. The good captain gave his word and promptly marched to the nearest British army camp to alert his superiors. Sweetenham didn't fight the Jacobites, therefore keeping to his word, but he headed south to keep well away from them. Charles's army began to move south towards the seat of power in Edinburgh, with a Jacobite successful skirmish near Highbridge and heading for the first major site, Ruthven Barracks. Ruthven had been built after the last rising in 1719 and was around 100 men, but at this point only had about 14 in it. 300 Jacobite troops threatened to storm the barracks and hang the defenders, but Sergeant Terence Molloy, an Irish veteran of the British forces, dared them to try. Jacobite men tried to set fire to the wooden gates, but the defenders put them out. Two Jacobites were killed and several were wounded by rifle fire. The government forces, by contrast, only lost one man, who unfortunately didn't listen to orders and stuck his head too far over the parapet. The Jacobites retreated and raided the nearby village of Ruthven for supplies. As O'Sullivan notes in his memoirs trying to explain his role in the Jacobite saga, this was a rather embarrassing stutter step in the campaign south. Whilst all of this was happening, Sir John Cope and around 2,500 troops marched from Stirling and went on the march to seize Carriarrick Pass, one of the main pathways from the Highlands to the Lowlands. It was the plan of the government forces to cut off access to the south, and with it, the road to Scotland's capital of Edinburgh. The problem was that by the time Cope and his troops got to the pass, the Jacobite forces were already in possession of the area, and to try and fight back would have been utter suicide. Inexplicably at this point, however, Cope decided to head to Inverness, the northern capital. Perhaps he felt the northern area and its ports should be defended to prevent extra troop landings from France. Maybe Cope needed supplies or wanted to request reinforcements and heavy guns to repel the rebels. Or maybe that was his first port of call to decide to head down south, as getting by sailboat would be quicker than on foot. Whatever his reason, this ended up committing a major tactical blunder. With this single move, Sir John Cope had left the road open for the Jacobites to march towards Edinburgh, and you'd best believe Charles and his troops pounced on that opportunity. The Jacobite army marched on the city of Perth, arriving September 3rd. King James III of England and 8th of Scotland was proclaimed in the city, and Jacobites and other supporters rallied there. Amongst these were Ewan Macpherson of Cluny, a chief of the Clan Macpherson. Interestingly, Macpherson had actually been head of a Highland company, and with his wife's urging, sided with the government right up to this point. He was arranging to support Sir John Cope and his men, but was sent home because he didn't have enough men rallied with him. He was then captured en route by a gang of Jacobite Camerons, relatives on his mother's side. Eventually, Macpherson was declared a Jacobite officer, whether by survival or of his own intent. This is going to be a recurring theme in this particular rising, of people either working one side or the other in terms of personal survival or gain. Others played both to see where they were better off. Macpherson could well have been one of these. He could have claimed to have operated as a Jacobite under duress, should he ever be caught by government troops. People aimed to protect their families, their land and their clan in whatever way they could. Some are accused of double dealing, but I'd be fairly certain people today, put in such a bind, would probably act in a similar fashion. Others followed what they felt were their own personal codes and honours. One such man in the Jacobite camp was Lord George Murray. Murray was a brother of William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine. Both had fought for King James in the 15 Rising and the attempted Rising in 19. Wounded at the Battle of Glenshiel, Lord George escaped to Europe, where, unlike the others, he returned to Scotland and was pardoned in 1724, even swearing allegiance to King George II in the 1730s. When Charles's landing was confirmed, George was actually appointed as a government advisor to Sir John Cope's military, and he was a sheriff in Perthshire. It came as a great shock, therefore, when Lord James Murray, his brother safe in Edinburgh pledging himself to the government, received a letter from George, his younger brother, announcing he'd sided with the Jacobites, stating even though he felt there was a slim chance of victory and that would lead to his ruin, he must honourably serve his king. It was said he only hesitated due to that very brother, but he still went to the rebel cause. With the acquisition of Lord George Murray, the Jacobites gained a younger Scottish noble who had a great deal of combat experience. Problems arose, however, from his own temper and arrogance, as well as his political opinions, having openly said Charles was a careless adventurer for doing this, and being one of the few Scots Jacobites who was pro-union with England. This, combined with his previous government affiliation, led some Jacobites to proclaim he was an agent sent to wreck the campaign. Lord George rejected this, but it helps highlight just how fractious and divided the Jacobite leadership was at this time. Spirits were still high, though, and Charles had his sights firmly set on the Scottish capital. The Jacobite army moved incredibly quickly for the 18th century, and this was thanks to George Wade in the 1720s. Yes, the actions of 20 years ago helped Prince Charles achieve his goals, because even today there's no way to physically prevent people walking on a road, yet only allowing your own troops. The military roads Wade built made traversing the country a lot easier, which was indeed his intention. But the Jacobites used this improved infrastructure too. Within 6 weeks of raising his standard, Charles and his army were at the gates of Edinburgh. The people in the city battened down the hatches and prepared for a long siege. Charles was at Gray's Mill, a small house near Edinburgh, and sending delegates to Edinburgh to discuss surrender. Eventually, 4 city nobles came to meet the prince. The prince had asked the city to open the gates and ensure that the arms of the town were handed over to the Jacobites. Trying to play for time, the city grandees asked if they could go to the people and see if they wished to surrender. The prince and his advisers, recognising it for the delaying tactic it was, agreed to allow them a couple of hours to mull it over. But if they took longer, possibly waiting to see if General Cope would come down to their rescue, then Jacobite forces would descend on the town and, in his words, take measures. The prince sent the delegation away, then told his own forces under command of Lochiel to arm up and march towards Edinburgh. The Jacobites were smart enough to expect that despite the rumours the Lord Provost, the man who was the senior authority in Edinburgh, being a Jacobite, it was clear that the city was hoping General Cope would arrive, and Edinburgh had received word of his forces sailing to Dunbar, only a few miles away. A second delegation was sent by the city, but it was swiftly turned around by the prince, with a message he was clear the first time, and Edinburgh needed to stop dithering and make their minds up. The delegation returned home. Unbeknown to them, the Jacobites had crept up, taking positions near the Netherbow port. As they were deciding what the best approach to get into Edinburgh would be, Jacobite scouts reported a carriage was approaching from the city. James Murray, Prince Charles's personal secretary who was guiding Lochiel's troops, recognised this as the same carriage that had brought the delegates to see Charles at Gray's Mill. The carriage approached the Netherbow port, the gate separating the Canongate neighbourhood from the city proper. Little side note here, the location of this now demolished gatehouse is marked by bronze tiles in the pavement in Edinburgh on the Royal Mile near the World's End pub. As the gates swung open, Lochiel and his men pounced. Storming the open gate, the Jacobites took the entrance without firing a shot. The city grandees were awaiting the arrival of their delegation when Colonel O'Sullivan, Prince Charles's quartermaster, entered Lucky Clark's tavern and joined them and told them they should just open the city to the Jacobites and the prince, without any resistance. If any house offered resistance, O'Sullivan promised he'd burn it to the ground. And so it came to be that on September 17th, 1745, Prince Charles Edward Stuart entered Edinburgh, dressed in Highland tartan with a velvet bonnet, and riding his horse before the crowds. With his Jacobite officers pointing out the landmarks, crowds gathered to see the prince. Some Jacobite accounts tell of crowds cheering, and whilst it's true to say Jacobites would paint themselves as liberating heroes, it's also equally as true to say many welcome the House of Stuart back to Scotland. The young prince slowly made his way to the palace of Holyrood House, home of the royal family in Scotland previously, but in all honesty, at this time it had fallen from its former glories. The prince in fact avoided staying in the rather dilapidated royal apartments, choosing to commandeer the Duke of Hamilton's quarters in which to reside. Charles was said by all who saw him to be smiling and happy, but his advisers said he seemed somewhat on edge. The Jacobites didn't enter Edinburgh with any pomp and circumstance in the way you would expect from a triumphant army, though Jacobite accounts explain they were cheered on by throngs of well-wishers, even if they exaggerated the numbers for propaganda purposes. Charles probably had in the back of his mind that the army up until this point hadn't been truly tested. It would only be a matter of time before Sir John Cope and his government force would be landing in the area and would march on Edinburgh to try and retake the city, giving the Jacobites their first major challenge. For now, though, they allowed themselves some celebration. Royal heralds were sent to the Mercat Cross in Edinburgh, and James's declaration as king and the manifesto of Prince Charles as regent were read aloud to the populace. The men were billeted in the city and nearby in Duddingston, and the populace were either rejoicing and shouting God save the king, or trying to keep their heads down as Highland troops, almost alien to this lowland populace, set about commandeering food, boarding and supplies. News of Edinburgh's fall had reached London and taken the administration almost completely by surprise. The Marquess of Tweedale, the Secretary of State for Scotland, wrote in disbelief that 2,000 men, the scum of two or three Highland gentlemen, should be able to make themselves masters of the town of Edinburgh. But he wrote in equal confidence that as of September 19th, General Sir John Cope and his troops had landed at Dunbar, just 30 miles from Edinburgh. In our next episode, we shall see the very first engagement of the British forces against the Jacobite rebels at the Battle of Prestonpans.